Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be back. Thank you to Jimmy and Joan for having me. And thanks everybody for coming out. Actually, I realized that the last time I read here a few years ago, I read a story from the same series. I'm slowly working my way through all the restaurants I've ever worked in for trying to go for a short story book about restaurants, set in restaurants. So this is actually set in the same place that the last one was, but the last one was like the deli side, and this is the bar side. So you'll see how that goes. And I also want to thank Jimmy for refusing to believe in writer's block. I've been working on this story for a long time, and I finally finished it last night. Woohoo! I know you know how that is. So this is called Happy Hour at the Sheila Nagara. When I moved back to Todd Avenue, I took a job right down the street, which was handy. It was a funny little establishment with a convenience store in front, a deli where I worked slicing meat, and a low-end bar called the Sheila Nagara. There were two gas pumps outside, which made it four businesses in one modest hut made of cinder blocks dressed in glossy gray paint. The Sheila Nagara, the name anyhow, was Frank's idea. He told the story to anyone who asked that Sheila Nagara was an Irish princess who was smuggled to Canada, fell in love with one of her kidnappers, and became the first European mother in the New World. Which was a stupid story to tell in Charlottesville because everybody here knows that Virginia Dare was the first white baby born this side of the Atlantic down on the Outer Banks. The history books in school, if you grew up around here, they talk for a long time about the tribes of Powhatan and John Smith and Pocahontas and the Virginia colony and the Roanoke colony and Jamestown and Williamsburg and the Battle of Yorktown and Patrick Henry and Thomas Jefferson and the Statute on Religious Freedom and the Battle of Second Manassas and the Battle of Mechanicsville and the Battle of Appomattox Station and the Battle of Chancellorsville and the Battle of the Wilderness leading to the Battle of Spotsylvania Courthouse and Robert E. Lee and Francis Lightfoot Lee, and Light Horse Harry Lee and Jubal Early. Our history classes spent so long on Virginia as the center of creation that they had to stop talking and let us go for the summer just as we reached World War II. All the Holocaust got was a statistic and a horrific photograph that was given to us mostly out of context. Then it was fighting the mosquitoes and ticks and leeches until late August, when we'd start again with Sir Walter Raleigh and the Savages. Audrey and I always said when we started a band, we'd call it Virginia Dared. Audrey worked up front at the convenience register. All afternoon and all evening, she'd ring up a steady stream of breeze-by customers in her crisp South Carolina accent. "That'll be $8.79 for you, ma'am. Did you need a bag today?" I'm not going to actually do the accent because I can't perfect it. The locals trusted her for her drawl and her modest banter, and the academics trusted her for her enunciation, her well-formed syllables. The breeze-by was the only store like it for a few miles in any direction, so everyone came to Audrey and bought the things they needed last minute or forgot at the supermarket. Their toilet paper and their half and half, their gasoline and magazines, their penny candy and 2 liters, their lotto tickets and dish soap, their tinned peaches and cans of Skoll, their cigarettes and styrofoam cups of coffee for the road, the six packs of Milwaukee's Best and bottles of Boone Farm kept people coming when everything else slowed down. The deli was owned by the same guys who owned the bar, and a different fellow ran both the grocery and the gas pumps. Audrey's boss was a local dude named Bob, and the deli guys were Frank and Randy. Randy was from South Florida, and Frank was from the north of Maine, and they had met somewhere in the middle in New York City. When they retired from whatever dreary offices they haunted in Midtown Manhattan, they drove to Virginia and opened a New York-style delicatessen. I never heard how the bar came into the plan. Audrey and I had a thing for singing the bar's name to the tune of the P.J. Harvey song, Sheila Na Gig. I don't remember when it started, but it became our salutation. Sheila Na Gare, Sheila Na Gare, you exhibitionist. It was usually me singing it to Audrey as I walked in the front door of the Breeze By, but sometimes it was Audrey singing it to me when she came through the deli to use the employee bathroom. Put money in your idle hole. On Saturdays, I had a late night radio show up at the university where I played punk songs from the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Riot Girl rockers were featured prominently. The women of Bikini Kill, Free Kitten, Tribe 8, 7-Year Bitch, Babes in Toyland, and lots of tracks from PJ Harvey. It was Audrey who first told me what a Sheila and a gig was, even though I'd been playing the song on my show for a couple of summers already. You'd recognize them by their oversized vulvas. $1.97 for you, sir. Mr. Harrison might have blushed as Audrey was ringing up his soft pack of Camel Unfiltereds, but I don't think he knew the word. Anyway, Audrey's elocution was so immaculate that she could get away with saying things I couldn't. Me, I often mumbled, and when I didn't, I spoke Yankee like my parents or cursed like my brothers. Kind of like gargoyles, but Irish. $7.68 for you, Ms. Sheffield. They're pagan carvings of these female creatures on old stone buildings. A big head and two hands holding the lips wide open like an empty purse. She bagged Mrs. Sheffield's Zima and green beans. There's a dispute over what they're for. Are the figures there to warn against women's sins or to honor female fertility? Audrey had majored in anthropology and came from a family of readers and storytellers. On the low days at work, when Frank was making the lunch rush worse with one of his tirades, when Randy was drinking daytimes and brushing too close to Krista in the back room, I only had to walk from behind the deli counter up through a short hallway to land in the candy aisle of the Breeze By and be in close speaking range with Audrey, by which I mean close singing range. Audrey and I could pick up the PJ Harvey song at any line during our workday and take the tune from there. Gonna wash that man right out of my hair. Krista in the deli had put several American states between her and her bruiser of an ex-boyfriend. Gonna wash that man right out of my hair. Audrey was still heartsick over the indie rock drummer who had traded her for a lobbyist job in D.C. Gonna take my hips to a man who cares. I was drawing comics about Joel in Philadelphia and kept running into Caleb and his new girlfriend around the radio station. Gonna take my hips to a man who cares. Polly Jean Harvey wasn't strictly speaking a Riot Girl band, but she had the power of a bard and a banshee, and that amounted to the same thing for us. As it turned out, Krista knew our PJ Harvey song too, and she got in on the game in her own way. She'd speak the lyrics instead of singing them, which always snuck up on me and made me giggle. Talking the song served less like an infectious drumming in my heart and more like a code language when we were really stuck on the line weighing meats on wax paper and scooping German potato salad into paper bowls. Krista would pull a Diet Dr. Pepper out of the drink case to go with a sandwich order and tell me, "You should see my bottle full of charm," while Frank was huffing and puffing in the background, "I'm waiting on 3 hot Sicilians and 2 coleslaws!" Or we'd be getting crushed under the happy hour orders. "You hiding from the good times, girly?" a fellow with a beer in his hand asked Krista as she waited on him at the register. "Turn the corner, another one there," she deadpanned to me, like it was restaurant slang for corned beef with a side of pasta salad. I half expected to see the lyrics written on the ticket she held out for me to grab. Around the time Krista started supplementing her part-time deli shifts with some bartending, I started hearing more about Tanya. Tanya appeared to be the only female regular at the Sheila Nagara. It seemed like any other lady could get dragged there once, but didn't find much to return for. Tanya came around every night. Tanya had a sunburnt face, hair that was bleached and permed to the point of falling out, and the few times I saw her off her stool, she stood about 5'1". She spoke in a voice that was scratched thin from cigarettes, but when she laughed, it was loud and from the gut. It carried into the deli and into my thoughts, which was the opposite of someone like Squirrel, who was always startling me when he tiptoed in from the bar to see about the butt ends of the cheese I was slicing. Squirrel never wanted to be a bother. Soon I learned to keep a pile of cheese rinds for him in the deli case. I walked all the way into town today, Squirrel often told me, like it was walking and not lack of money that made him hungry. Squirrel's face was more sunburnt than Tanya's. Krista said that when Tanya got far enough into the night, there was a certain routine. Like, after she spent 20 minutes in the parking lot puking up the first few hours of beer, she'd come back into the Sheila Nagara in a slightly different mood and start saying to the fella next to her, whoever it was, "Wanna see my boobs?" Before the guy could get excited or horrified, politely decline, or answer in the affirmative, Tanya would pull up her top and flash the whole bar. This she did repeatedly until close. It made Tanya laugh every time, Krista said. I never had much cause to interact with Tanya. She might start drinking before happy hour and stay until close, but I never saw her eat. But one afternoon when it was slow, and Bob was at the convenience working the register, and Randy was out of town, and Krista and Audrey and I found ourselves hanging around the bar, Audrey asked what was that doll up by the television. "That's Sheila!" Tanya yelled out from the bar and started falling over laughing. Audrey got a stool, and I spotted her while she took the fading cloth doll down from the corner. It looked like the kind of doll that had probably been hand-sewn for daughters and granddaughters around the mountains and foothills for centuries, so it was hard to tell how old it was. Besides that, she didn't really seem like Frank or Randy's taste in a mascot. For some reason, Krista had the instinct to pull up her skirt, and we saw that Sheila was, well, anatomically correct. "A 19th century sex doll?" I asked. "I mean, they would have had them," said Audrey, the anthropologist. "But why does the bar?" The three of us let out a collective groan just thinking about the lonely men at the Sheila Nagara and their TV sex doll. "Yeah, but who says it wasn't mutual?" Tanya bellowed from the bar. She let out a longer laugh than usual. Of course, we started trying to come up with a plan to save Sheila. From Frank and Randy, from the bar guys, from whoever had kept her up on a TV shelf to advertise her next to Petticoat Junction and Ralph Sampson. The obvious thing was to kidnap her, but we wondered if that would be enough. "She needs to be avenged," Audrey insisted, and we had to agree. We were sitting in the back corner booth of the deli that night after Frank and Bob had left. Audrey had a large Coke spiked with bourbon Krista had snuck over from the bar, and I had a pint of Haagen-Dazs from the freezer case up front. Sheila the doll was propped up on one end of the table. We stared at her for a while in silence. "Tell me again why we work here, Audrey." "Sure thing, tell me the alternative and I'll tell you why we don't." "What about the Colette Cafe up on Elliewood?" "Okay, that chef might have gotten a PhD in comparative literature, but the second his hostess wife goes home, he can't remember that he's married. He thinks waitress means mistress." "El Greco's? Those insulting little rich boys treat you like their maid and their concubine in the same breath." "The Queen's Head? Renee said that she made really good tips there." "Fine if you want to wear an antebellum costume." "Kelly's Cafe? Button-down shirts and penny loafers." "Tokyo Rose? You don't have enough cleavage, my friend." "The Dark Horse Tavern?" "They kept the rapist bartender and fired the waitress who accused him." "The Yellow Cactus? The owner auditions his servers in little black dresses in his office and has high turnover." "What about temping?" "Eliza, are you serious? Roy, tell Eliza why we don't work office jobs." Roy, who had worked nights for at least a decade, laughed to himself and held a finger up to Audrey. He disappeared around the corner towards the walk-in and came out not a full minute later. He made his way to our table with a funny, stoned face. He said nothing as he served us a plate of pumpernickel bread and garnish. On the bread was a reasonable likeness of Thomas Jefferson, drawn in squeeze mayo. And below Mr. Jefferson's chin was a ruff made of lettuce. Then Roy exhaled a cloud of marijuana smoke over our table. "Eliza," Roy drawled in my direction, "I don't know about you, but I will always prefer the night shift." We put Sheila back on her perch when we left that night, and Audrey flicked some seltzer on her like holy water for protection. But when we came back the next day, Sheila was gone without a trace. By the end of that year, Audrey, Krista, and I had moved on to other things, and we never lived in the same city again. I still think about them, and I still think about Sheila, too. I wonder if Sheila ended up as Krista's roommate or Audrey's dissertation. I wondered if Tanya had hid her from the boys of the bar or from us girls who are willing to kidnap the kidnapped. And I wonder what PJ Harvey would have done. Thank you so much.